I'd like to invite Peter up to the podium, and please, I was a principal and a superintendent for 35 years, and if you start to give a speech, I'm going to have you stand in that corner over there, and I've got four corners, so please, ask your question and keep it brief so we can enjoy Peter. Thank you, Peter.
Go ahead. There's a microphone at the back.
Peter, Mike Cormacan, federal Liberal candidate. I'm curious as to why you have never run yourself. You seem to be such an adept analyst of all of this. I'm wondering, is it a fair question?
There are lots of people who study music but can't play a musical instrument. I think of myself as being in that category. It's way more fun to stand back afterward and say what you did wrong than actually have to do it right myself in the first place. So I.
And after you saw what happened to the audience.
That's right, yeah. Look what happens to academics in office, yeah.
Next question.
My name is Knut Peterson. Peter, could you comment on the possibility of proportional representation ever arriving at the Canadian political forum?
I warned you not to get me started on this. Never ask a political scientist about proportional representation. Everyone write this down. This is important. Proportional representation is to political scientists what catnip is to cats, right? I mean, we just can't resist it. When we're rolling around in it, we feel silly and giddy and do funny things. But it doesn't do any lasting harm to anybody, including us. But, okay, our electoral system is a colossal problem, but changing it is very difficult because you're always asking the people who are winning under the current system to change the system under which they are winning. Strangely enough, they're always reluctant, you know. Just after they've lost, they're often willing to consider it, at least theoretically. But as soon as they get back in office, suddenly it's, well, how can a system that gave you me have any problems with it? You know, it's I think the uphill struggle is pretty massive. I've regretted for a long that the real trouble with our electoral system is it does not let people cast a nuanced vote. It's like, you know, playing the piano with mittens is our electoral system. Even if you had a much more nuanced, thought through, focused idea, in the end, all you get to do is bang on one end of the piano rather than actually play a tune. I'll switch away from music any minute. I don't know why. Went up there two questions in a row.
My name is Van Christou. Peter, I wonder if you could tell us your opinion regarding the possibility of a severe and sharp downturn in the economy. Some indications that we're getting right now might happen. And whether or not Canadians will relate that downturn to conservative policy in the United States and to our conservative government here, and do you think that would happen soon enough to reflect any difference in this coming election?
But four questions wrapped in one, and all of them directed toward an economist. There was a time when political science and economics were a single discipline called political economy. That was changed by the time I started university. So just very briefly, I think the Americans have got themselves in a hole they've been digging for a long time. We've been warned for years that the credit situation in the U.S. was building up to a very dangerous level. And instead of working to fix it, when you look at that, what a subprime mortgage is, you look at that and you say, you gotta be kidding. I mean, the idea in a subprime mortgage is you want to buy a house and I offer you a mortgage, and right up front for X months, and it's not a large number, but say 6 months, you will pay only 1% interest on your mortgage. How can you beat that? Now, of course, true, in month 7, it's going to ratchet up to some much higher number I can't tell you about right now. But nonetheless, for the first 6 months, isn't this marvelous? Come month 7, you're dead, you know? So what are we doing? What was that? And then, you know, gee, it went sour. Golly, that's astonishing. I never would have guessed that would go sour, would you? So the Americans have set themselves up for some kind of a real financial crunch. The problem is, we're in bed with the Americans. It's called the North American continent. So whatever happens in the U.S. will affect us. I hate to sound like Stephen Harper, but I think our fundamentals are sound. No, I don't think we've gone down a lot of the same roads the Americans did, but unfortunately, we are so linked to them. Anything they get, we get. Any problems they have wash over the border. And I do not know, and I, like a lot of people, I have trouble going to sleep at night thinking about it. I don't know how bad it's likely to get in the next year, six, you know, a year and a half, 2 years. I hope not too bad, but yeah, it'll get worse. And who will get blamed for it? Well, governments in power always get blamed for it, whether or not there was anything they could have done, and that's too deeply ingrained a game for me to try to challenge.
Peter, my name is Tom Kane, and I'm concerned about the polls and the way they go. You said that you have to keep looking at various polls because they're going to be different from the one before, but Canadians consistently say, I think something like 65% or greater, want something done about climate change and pollution. What kind of a paradox have we got that we keep re-electing possibly re-elect the Conservative government that has such a dismal track record on the environment? It's like the Prime Minister has been named one of the worst political leaders in the world when you talk about climate change. How do we do that? How come the poll says we don't want that, but after Election Day, we seem to have it?
Okay, first, 2 points. The first one is that, you know, the 40-30-30 Canada I was talking about. The problem is that those who are really in favor of doing something about climate change are divided among several political parties. So even if that comes through as the final voting choice, it's scattered and the other vote is clustered. Second reason, a lot of Canadians say they're really concerned about it, and then there's a meltdown in Wall Street and they don't care about it quite that much after all, thank you. I think we got diverted partway through the campaign. This could have turned into the first really green election campaign with global warming the central issue. But the big question in any campaign is what is going to turn out to be the central question? And I'm afraid the Americans answered that one for us. The central question is going to be the economy. So the environmental global climate change is going to get pushed to one side. I say this not out of enthusiasm and not because I support it. I just say that's the way the campaign's gone so far. So, for example, for the Liberals, wait and see how often they actually talk about the green check. They will talk instead about sound economic management, and you can't trust Stephen Harper. You'll hear 47 of those for one mention of the green shift. I hope you enjoyed the talk about the green shift in the first week and a half of the campaign. That was it. It's sort of in one focused example, I think that's what's happened in this campaign. Mark.
Peter, I'm Mark Sandilands, federal NDP candidate. Are you aware of a study that shows that NDP governments are the most fiscally responsible? It was done by the Federal Department of Finance, showing that NDP governments, territorial and provincial, balance their budgets just under half the time, Conservatives about one-third of the time, and Liberal governments about one-quarter of the time. And if you're not aware of it, why not?
Perhaps Mr. Sandilands misunderstood the purpose of my being here and the comments I was trying to make. I did lead off my comment on the impact of the centrality of the economic issues by saying, fairly or unfairly, I think this is how it's going to play out. Not endorsing it, I'm indicating how I think the issue is going to impact on those voters who are still in play. I do think there's a massive irony in the fact that the NDP has actually loaned their poster child for economic disaster to the Liberals, and now it's really a question of who gets to use Bob Rae as the horrible example for whom. That's not the face you want in. But does he count as a bad performance for New Democrats, because that's what he was? Or does he count as bad performance for Liberals, because that's who he is right now? So an interesting sideshow to the campaign. Now, I agree completely that we tend to reduce an awful lot of politics to facile slogans that don't always hold up under really close scrutiny, but I'm afraid facile slogans are what a lot of voters use to guide their decisions, especially the ones who are making up their mind in the closing seconds of the campaign. So I didn't say quite rightly we're going to trash the NDP. I did not say that. I said fairly or unfairly, here's how it's going to play out.
Supplemental. You didn't answer my question. Are you aware of the study? And if not, why not?
I'm on leave.
So I take
it the
answer
is
no.
The charter. If you want to talk about Section 15...
I take it the answer is no.
The answer is no. I was not aware of the study. I do not doubt it. The NDP has... the NDP in office provincially has given us some excellent governments that have stood up very well. Parties pick up labels and reputations that stay with them long after the factual basis has drifted away. I acknowledge cheerfully that there is no reason to think that the NDP in office nationally would be any worse than any of the clowns we've elected, than any of the parties that have formed the government in the past.
Hi, Peter, Bev Mendel. Thank you very much for your enlightening and enthusiastic and fun talk. I'd like to know, if you look at the numbers on the polls, it looks like, you know, there's overwhelmingly more voters on the left. What would you think about a coalition government, and is it possible, like, could the left-leaning parties become a coalition government? And Stephen Harper says over his dead body, but is it still possible to do that?
The difficulty with... Okay, first of all, you don't get to talk about coalitions before the election because every party wants you to vote for them. Coalition, we don't normally use coalitions in Canada. Our one experience with a coalition government was during the Union government during World War I. Our one national experience with coalition was the Union government in World War I. And the general political wisdom of that was it didn't work out too well. So there's a reluctance to go into minority government, coalition governments. We tend to go for minorities that are supported by some sort of implicit agreement with one or more of the opposition parties. Coalitions are unlikely. And at any rate, the problem is that the people who support the parties on the left don't support the left in some mystical sense. They support a particular party on the left. So there are a lot of New Democrats who say, it's not that I'm a New Democrat because I'm a left-winger and I got confused. I'm a New Democrat because I'm a New Democrat. And the liberals would say, it's not that I vote liberal because I'm a left-winger and I got confused. I'm a liberal. There's real differences between the parties that matter a lot to the members of the party, the activists, and a lot of the people who support them. And by stirring them all into one melting pot, first of all, it looks like you say, well, we were kidding for the last 20 years, I hope you don't mind. And also you risk losing some of the people who don't like your blended package. It was something you blended out that they really liked the best. So coalitions are unlikely. Over the long run, will the party system shake itself out to give us a really clear left center alternative to the right of center conservatives? Yeah, party systems do that. The divided right was the situation we had for a decade. That one sorted itself out. Party systems tend to respond to those problems. But I don't think a coalition... I don't think talk about the coalition during an election campaign is the way to deal with that. I'm not even sure a coalition after the election is the best way to deal with that.
The specter that you painted on the wall, that Harper would get in again, and the other parties would just be minor parties with the Liberals opposition, in fact, gives me the idea that we would be having a de facto coalition, because when people vote, they would be voting along philosophical lines. So I guess what you're really saying is until there's a new leader of the Liberals, we're stuck with the Conservatives.
I did not say that. Okay. A coalition government is a much more formal arrangement. I mean, obviously, any minority government survives only because they can put together a package of things that at any particular time draws enough votes to pass, whether that's the support of an opposition party or whether that's the Liberals leaving the chamber while the vote takes place, but you know, enough to get that particular measure through. The mere fact that a minority government can survive by virtue of the behavior of one or more opposition parties does not make a coalition. coalition. A coalition is I am party X, you are party Y. Let's sit down, let's divide the cabinet. The cabinet has 30 members, I get 20 because I'm bigger, you get 10. Now let's talk about which 20 I get, which 10 you get. I want defense, you want finance. I want justice, you want... And we go down and we divide up the whole cabinet on that basis. Then we meet together and work out a joint strategy and we march in together, and that's a coalition. A coalition is, you know, whenever we use the term de facto coalition, no, it's a de facto temporary passing alliance, which is quite different from a coalition, which is formal. Obviously, any minority government will form a de facto working alliance with somebody, or else they won't be the minority government any longer. Yes?
Art Sanford, Peter, and very interesting, and since the moderator, Ed, there decided to try and back you in a corner, he said you would make fearless predictions. So the fearless prediction is the Liberal Party, which we're talking about, it's pretty obvious that Dion is going to crash and burn. Who's going to be the next leader? And how, is there going to be blood on the floor, and is it going to divide the party even more?
Okay, I probably want to stick my neck out on this one. What I was astonished by, I mean, the comments I made about the bench strength of the Liberal Party are very important to bear in mind. I thought when Martin stepped down, I thought like everybody else, I could name the first five people who would be running for leader of the Liberal Party. All five of them said, sorry, I'm busy, no thanks. And you know, all of my picks disappeared in the first five, you know, before there was a race. And the Liberals then generated an interesting set of individuals who ran one heck of a leadership race. And I would have been hard-pressed to come up with any of them ahead of time. One thing that may happen, and it's not too long since the last race, so maybe this is the answer, is the front runners from last time will start off as the Crown Prince is heading into this next one, which takes the Liberals again toward the deadlock, which would be really bad news for them. You know, Ray and Ignatieff were the neck and neck runners last time. I would think they'll start off, they will run again, they'll have an advantage. But the Liberals have tremendous bench strength. There are other people who could show up and run, and we could wind up with someone who will be saying, wow, how about that? You know, and I never really saw that one coming. I don't think the Liberals, okay, again, sorry, Stefan, I have to say this. I don't think the Liberals will have any trouble whatever coming up with a better, more convincing, more rallying leader than their current one, and it could be any of half a dozen Liberals. However evasive, eh? I'm not sure who it'll be, but I don't think they'll have any trouble beating replacing the current one with a stronger choice.
Gerald Wolven, I'm just wondering, do you think there'll ever be fixed election dates written in stone, or is it going to be like what was
my
that?
My friend, where have you been? We have fixed election dates. Just read the statutes of Parliament.
I asked you, would it be written in stone?
No. Oh. Will we ever have them? They're difficult to work into a parliamentary system, because you always have to have this motion of confidence qualifier, you know, stuck in the corner. There has been a push in that direction. Harper did not invent this idea. Various provincial governments have undertaken similar commitments that have this, you know, so written in stone, no, they're exactly as binding as Stephen Harper's was. But there is a movement in that direction. I'm not sure how far you can go in a parliamentary system. And I think whatever happens to Harper in this election will be taken as a bit of a lesson to all of us in what the fixed election date thing and the commitment to it means in practice. But entrenched, I wouldn't want to draft the legislation to entrench it. I'd be too worried I'd miss something. I don't think we'll get it.
Graham Greenlee is the name. Peter, what sort of a format would you suggest for the leadership debate, given that there's five individuals involved?
Okay, Eddie, first of all, I suspect that right up front that the ideal format for the leadership debate in Canada is a question that does not actually have a good answer. So I will give you my bad answer. My bad answer would be to get around the pretense of five exactly equal people and understand that the different leaders taking part in the debate are doing so from different starting points with different possible outcomes, and then to organize matchups based on that without meaning any unnecessary disrespect to either one of them. I think we can all agree that having a chunk of the leaders' debate devoted to Gilles Duceppe and Elizabeth May taking each other on in the English debate would be when you'd all find something else to do for 5 minutes, right? I can't see the world hinging on that. But Stéphane Dion versus Harper, Leighton versus Harper, Leighton versus Dion, that is the drama of this election campaign. And we're being denied any real chance for those people to go one-on-one and demonstrate their mettle. I would want to see a format that would give us the one-on-one matchups that really matter without inflicting on us the one-on-one matchups that don't. And if you think you can do that without causing a public outcry, good luck.
Peter, my name is Jack Dick, and this question is on the environment, and it's so obvious because nothing has been said about it, and I want to know what the various thoughts are from the different parties, why it hasn't been brought up, because it's the most important to me. Is the rape of Northern Alberta in the oil sands, which is a very polluting thing, and the rape of Northern Saskatchewan and Ontario for the uranium that's being taken out by France. France controls it now. So what are your views, or what are the views within the group here?
Okay, Canada as a trading nation relies heavily on the extraction of primary materials from the land and shipping them abroad. We are still in the 21st century, as we were in the 19th century, that kind of a country. And much of that does inflict lasting impact upon our climate, upon the country that you can see from the air, as Jack Layton did in that, to me, very dramatic, very nicely done opening pitch in his campaign. The only thing I can say in reply, first of all, a lot of the damage takes place far enough away that most of us don't have to think about it a whole lot. So I'm not saying it's a brilliant answer, I'm just saying the average person in Lethbridge does not very often see what they're doing to Fort McMurray. Therefore, it doesn't impact you directly. And second, an awful lot of Canadians know darn well that our affluence, our wealth, our comfortable standard of living rests in significant part on the rape of the land you're describing, and it's just the way life is. And I would think those two factors explain most of why people don't care a whole lot, and why when it comes up in election campaigns, it doesn't have the bite that many people would like it to have.
I'm sorry, but I think that should be investigated by people that are interested in their life. There's too much pollution from the two items I mentioned. There's no protection from the waste, which pollutes the whole world. The waste, nobody has told me what to do about the waste.
You ask me why it is that it doesn't show up in elections and why it doesn't loom larger, I answered that. I agree completely. I mean, I love one of the things that people at my table noticed, I'm really into the way we change the way we word things to have a spin built into it. So when I was growing up, we had something called the tar sands up in Athabasca, right? Athabasca tar sands. God, does that sound gunky and bad, right? What has that become? It's become the oil sands. All we have to do is let the oil drip out of it. No, it's tar sands, for God's sake. That was the accurate label. And in the same way, in the States, we used to have a bailout. Now they're working on the rescue plan. I love it. But in the case of the example that comes to mind in connection with your question, what we have upstairs up north in Canada is tailings ponds. What the heck is that? No, they're actually sludge oceans, you know, that we're generating up there. They are... you know, pools of stinking death that cover, you know, hundreds and hundreds of acres. But we call them tailing tailings pond. How can you get excited about a tailings pond? It sounds like it would fit in your backyard without too much. And no, these ones wouldn't, and you sure wouldn't want them in your backyard. So, yeah, there is a real information problem, and I agree completely that our oil sands, as we now call tar sands, as we should call them, are a colossal global environmental problem. And kudos to the NDP for taking it on. I will even say kudos to Michael Byers for actually saying it the way it should be said. Yeah, it is a problem. It needs to be confronted and debated and not just swept off the table all the time.
Thank you, Peter, for a most incisive talk. You're always humorous, and in response to the questions, you don't evade any of them, even when they come from Mark Sanderlands. Remember, there's a election forum on Monday night at 7 o'clock at the library, and next week, Bridget Pasteur will be talking about, are we giving the Stelmach government a free ride? Peter, I would like to have you back after the election and when the economic crisis is down to have another incisive review. Thank you very much.